Welcome to the XYZ Experiment Podcast. Today, we have myself, obviously, Dash. I'm your Gen Y. We have Fiona, Gen X, and Luke, Gen Z. And we have our guest, Marta. Welcome, Marta.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
We are going to actually be speaking to Marta for two episodes. And our first episode, we're going to be chatting to Marta about her story of coming to Australia and growing up in Australia. Yeah, thank you so much for joining us and telling us this very important story.
Thank you.
Marta, when we do this podcast, we always ask someone to tell us what generation they belong to. Mm-hmm. So what generation do you belong to?
Gen X.
And what's the most Gen X thing about you?
Oh, my gosh. There's nothing specifically I don't think about Gen X in terms of fitting into the criteria. I looked at all the different kind of, you know, what Gen X are supposed to be. All I can say is that with age comes wisdom, confidence. There's a real sort of, genuine enjoyment in things. Whereas when I was younger, you know, I was always rushing around and, you know, like a bull at a gate. But I actually do feel younger than I am as well. Like I love having a lot of fun in life. I love having, you know, really nice time. I love being silly. I love being active. So there's these sort of young components of me, and then there's these sort of older, genuinely Gen X components of me that come with age.
Can I ask something around that? Because we always ask our guests that question.
Yeah.
Do you think based in culturally where you're from, that generation is a thing? Is it broken? Like we talk about boomers and Gen X and Gen Y, Gen Z. Mm-hmm. Is it like that for you, or is it more an older generation, a younger generation?
For me, there's almost no one, that makes sense. And I was always used to find it really interesting when my children were at school and children at a certain age only spent time together around that age group, and mothers would only invite, so if their child was 10, they would only invite 10-year-olds to the birthday party. If a mother was 35, she would generally sort of spend time around other mothers that were around 35. Whereas I've always enjoyed having older friends, younger friends, and there's not really a big focus, certainly not in my life, around age.
Yeah.
It's more around how well you get along with people and how much you enjoy that person's company.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. I am mother of three. I immigrated to Australia when I was 8, and fast forward my time, I'm very much what you would probably call a traditional, sort of back then traditional kind of person, in the sense that, you know, I had children very young. And then when I was in my 30s, I decided that I had a lot more to give, and I actually had a brain. I could feel it. I went to university, and then I went, you know, progressed from an undergrad to an honours to a PhD. I think if I was to describe myself personally, I'd say, you know, I love being outdoors. I love being active. I love doing things and cooperating with other people, and I love working things out. So I'm a very sort of curious person, which I probably got from my mum. I've got the adventurous from my dad, and I've got the curiosity from my mum. So, if I was going to describe myself, I think I am very European in that way. Like, it's all outdoors, very little TV, that kind of person, yeah.
So when you were back at university, you had three little ones?
Yeah. I decided to go back when my youngest started prep.
Yes.
And I actually worked part-time 2 days a week, and went part-time to university and had the children full-time. I do have to give a lot of credit to my mum, because she would stay and look after the children two nights a week. So she'd pick up them up from school one day, and then she'd stay two nights and help me out, and then she'd go home. And I remember coming home from uni or from work, and there'd be like 6 dishes cooked up, and all the clothes have been washed and folded, and you know, homework done, and kids were happy. And so I couldn't have done that without that incredible support from mum. But, yeah, I consciously went back when my youngest started prep.
The power of family, honestly. It's incredible.
Yeah. And I have to also say, she pretty much did half my degree with me, because she would read all my assignments and I'd ask her all the questions, and we would sit for hours talking about some sort of theory, you know. It was a wonderful time.
That's so beautiful.
Yeah.
I take it you're multilingual?
Yes. Yes.
So when you and your mum speak, you're speaking in English, you're speaking in Czech. Yep. What are you speaking in?
We speak Czech.
Yeah.
But I have to say that because my contact with the Czech community is limited, mum and I have started inventing our own words as time progressed. So we would start a word in English and we would end it in Czech, or it was like a Czech English word of our own. I think we have developed our own specific language. And you only realise when you start talking to other Czech people, or I watch Czech movies and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, like if I went to Czech Republic now, I'd probably be speaking quite rude Czech. Because in Czech you it's called tikat, which means you can, once you know someone well, you speak you end your words differently. But I always do that anyway. And I do remember when I went back there when my kids were younger and we all went, my grandmother, I asked a person the time and I asked them in an informal way, and my grandmother hid behind a post because she was so embarrassed. She's like, oh my God, what are you doing? She's like, I couldn't. She goes, I will never let you ask someone the time again. Just don't talk to people.
Outside the family, you're only allowed to talk to us.
I can relate to that because my grandparents migrated to Australia almost maybe 50 or 60 years ago now. I think they're at a point, it was really interesting talking to them about where they had actually been living in Australia longer than they had been in Greece. And there was a new, like the language developed in a way that is very culturally specific to Greek Australians. And so when I went to Greece and would try out a little bit of my Greek, half of the words I didn't even realize weren't actually like proper Greek. It was actually like some sort of like amalgamation that they wouldn't have even understood.
That's right.
Which is really interesting. Marta, what I wanted to ask about, because you mentioned that you migrated to Australia when you were 8, and I love talking, particularly when we're talking about Australians migrating, it's really, really interesting hearing these migration stories because we've got such like a diverse group of people that live in Melbourne. Would you mind telling us the story or a little bit about how you came to come to Australia?
Yeah, sure. So we migrated, we left Czech Republic, and I do use the word escape because that's essentially what happened in 1982 when the communist regime was in power. And I do have to say that this, everything, you know, I describe is very much taken from the perspective of what my parents have told me, because I was a child and I didn't, I didn't really experience the things that they did or that society did. But under the communist regime, basically your life was fully controlled. From the movies that you could see, what was shown on TV, the availability of products and food was really limited. Where you could work, often, you know, you couldn't have a choice where you worked. So my mum worked in childcare, and there was a childcare centre, you know, 2 minutes down the road from us. And they had a vacancy, but the Communist Party actually placed her in a childcare centre like 40 minutes by tram away because they could. You know, nobody really had those kinds of choices. Everything was really limited. The borders were closed off. If you wanted to go on holiday outside of the Czechoslovakia at the time, you had to apply for a visa from the government and it had to be approved and you had to justify it. So every aspect of your life was controlled, and you couldn't freely talk about the Communist Party at all, Luke. Like, you couldn't sit there and say, you know, I don't like this, because if somebody had found out that you spoke negatively, you'd actually go to jail or you'd be interrogated. And my parents have always been more liberal kind of thinkers, and they didn't like living under the communist regime. Some people did, because everybody had a job. You know, schooling was the same. You know, you didn't have to worry about a lot of things. But my parents didn't like that level of constriction and level of, you know, not having that choice and independence. And so I think that really shaped their decision to migrate, to leave the country. But there's also an element of the fact that, you know, my dad has more of an adventurous, curious side of him, and he wanted to also go. So I think a combination of my dad and a combination of, you know, what was politically happening in the country at the time meant that, you know, my parents had made that decision to leave.
How old were your parents?
So my mum was 27 when I was born. So my mum was 34, my dad was 36. Mm-hmm. So still quite young.
Had they travelled much around Europe?
Oh, look, I grew up, and this is what I mean, I didn't feel that political climate because my parents had always taken me, you know, and my brother, like we had, you know, we were always out. We were skiing under, sounds a bit, you know, strange to say, but under communism, a lot of people were given by the government a little country cottage, like, and I'm talking a really kind of basic country cottage, but it was still, and we used to go there and stay there all the time. And my parents were always travelling into hills, mountains, rivers, waters and things like that. So, yeah, absolutely. Like, it wasn't uncommon for me to feel travel and to, you know.
And then how did your parents go about enacting that plan of moving on?
Yeah, so I nobody could know that they were planning on leaving. So, and actually neither my brother nor I. I have a brother who's 18 months older, and you see, children don't know, but they know. You know, we sense that kind of, you know, that there's something happening, you know, things are being packed, there's a lot of secrecy. I can still actually see it in my mind. And so they made the decision, and I don't feel like it was really long. Like, I feel like it was only maybe 3 weeks, and they only told one other person, and it sounds silly, but they actually smuggled to that family a box of photos. Because if you were seen to be travelling with, like, you know, bed linen or clothes or, you know, anything, moving things around, and, you know, the communist regime got a hint of that you were, you know, that there was something strange going on, then they would interrogate you. So it was absolute secrecy. And I think this is where the real sadness is, because not even my grandmother and grandfather knew.
Oh, wow.
So when we left, they had no idea.
So you didn't get to say goodbye or anything?
Well, actually, I did, but I didn't. On the day we left, Mum and Dad said that they were going on a holiday. They applied for a visa to go to Yugoslavia. So they actually did apply and pretend that they were going on holiday. And because of that, what we travelled with was absolutely basic minimum. You know, Dad had to hide money behind the rearview mirrors in the car. We had basically each a pillow, a blanket. I was only allowed to take like one toy with me, a couple of pieces of clothing. It had to look like you were going on a 1 week holiday. And so before we left, my mum went to say goodbye, like pretend to my grandmother, just to say, you know, we're going on a holiday. And I still remember running through my grandmother's legs to the kitchen to her cookie jar and my mum being really nervous and giving my grandmother a hug, giving her mum a big hug. And my grandmother's going, well, why are you so nervous? It's okay. She always runs to the cookie jar. And Mum was beautifully dressed in this kind of, she tried to look nice for her mum on the last day. And I just remember this I could feel it, but my grandmother couldn't understand it. She just thought that Mum was probably having a bad day.
Yeah. You go on your week-long trip.
Yeah.
So you're driving across the border.
Yeah.
Then so what happens?
So we got stopped 3 times across the border. And we almost got caught out. Parents told me, you know, many years later that my dad served in the army with one of the border controllers, and he actually ended up letting them through.
Wow.
But the other guy was suspicious, and they were going to, we were actually going to be caught out. But I was actually going to say one of the biggest things that's in my memory is the one thing I was allowed to take with me was this little red suitcase and a doll, and that's it. And I remember we were driving out of Prague, and I opened up the suitcase, looked at my doll and hugged it, and looked into the back window, through the back window, and I just said, goodbye, goodbye home, I'll never see you again. Like, I actually remember being 8 and thinking and knowing that I was never going to come back there again. And then just my mind just went blank into almost like a, you know, stop thinking and just hugged the doll.
Wow.
It was such a big.
Do you think that was just the intuition of a child, knowing that something like a big change was happening?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I felt it all along, and I and I didn't really know what to think of it. I didn't feel sadness. I felt sadness because I had my grandmother and I had a connection that is really hard to, you know, like hard to find. Like we were really, really close. And I can only imagine what she went through when eventually they found out that we had escaped, because then they would raid our place. They would interrogate all the family. So it was, so as a child, yeah, absolutely, Luke. It was intuition of what was happening. And I just remember thinking, just don't be naughty, because Mum's always sad. So I didn't want to upset her. Like I didn't, she was always sad. Yeah. And so when we got to Yugoslavia, to the refugee camp, you know, they accepted us, and there were lots of other people there from the Czech community as well. And then, yeah, we stayed there for 3 months until we were accepted by Australia. In minus 30 degrees, in freezing cold too, like it was no money. We had no, we arrived to Australia with one suitcase, $200 and a pillow each. So,
oh, gosh.
Yeah.
So you applied for Australia. Did you apply for any other places?
Yeah. So we applied to USA first.
Okay.
Then Canada, then Australia, then New Zealand.
And was it waiting to hear back each time, or did you apply for them all at the same time?
All at the same time.
Okay.
All at the same time. And my dad was really adamant that he wanted to go to US, but people around were saying, look, you don't know when the next intake will be. You might be here for a year, you might be here for 6 months. You can just go to Australia, and then when you get there, you settle, and then you can go to the USA. You know, don't risk it. You've got a family. Like, there was no money. People were sharing resources. You know, there was so much insecurity. It's not like, you know, if he said no, then you'd be like, okay, you know.
Because you were basically not getting school during that time.
No.
Like, how did, what was like the environment of the refugee camp?
Oh,
like,
it was terrible.
Yeah.
Because it was just like little huts everywhere, like these little wooden huts, and minus 30 degrees. It was freezing cold. And everyone was almost in this sort of panic, waiting in this kind of like limbo, waiting to be told that they were going to be accepted somewhere. And unless you had family in the USA or Canada, they had just absolutely zero. They had stopped taking. But even when we arrived to Australia, we arrived to Sydney, and then they said, okay, hop on the bus, you're going to Adelaide. And my dad said, no, we thought we were going to be in Sydney. And the guy said, if you want to be in Sydney, then hop off the bus and look after yourself. If you want support, you have to go to Adelaide, because you guys have been allocated to Adelaide.
Oh.
And so yeah. Did you hop on the bus?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. With so few resources. And because certainly, like, my brother and I knew one word in English, which was hello. I didn't know anything about Australia, because it's not like you plan to go. You know, you were taken away all of a sudden. You're in a refugee camp as a child, and then you get put on an aeroplane, and you get landed in a country which was so foreign, like Australia 40 years ago, or a little bit more actually. And South Australia back then was really, you know. Yeah, so we really had no choice in, and so as a child you don't know, you just go along with what your parents, where your parents are telling you to, what your parents are telling you to do, where your parents are wanting you to go.
That must have been such an exhausting journey to fly all that way, land in Sydney, and then get on a bus to Adelaide.
Which is a long way away. Yeah.
Yeah.
Initially then, what were kind of the biggest challenges you found? Because I could imagine the landscape from what you were talking about, going out, skiing, being in the outdoors, to then, you know, South Australia, very different landscape, obviously different cultures. You mentioned that you weren't super fluent in the language either. Initially, what were you finding kind of the hardest parts of moving there to acclimate to?
If I was to down to one thing, I think I would say to you, empty loneliness as a child. I really do. I remember sitting in the camp for refugees in South Australia, and sitting on the grass, and somebody had given me a Barbie doll. And I'd never seen Barbie dolls before. And I was looking at this doll going, oh my God, it was 40 degrees, and I had, there was nobody around, and I just, and my parents were out looking for jobs and work, like just to earn any kind of money. And just sitting there in front of this paper thin hut, you know, one of those camping kind of, when you go to a caravan park kind of cabins, but really, you know, again, 41 years ago, like no air conditioning, nothing. And just thinking, what did my parents do? Like, why am I even here? And then the next day, Mum and I went, had to go to the shop, and we were standing at these ginormous traffic lights in South Australia with no trees anywhere. And it was so hot that you could see the ground, like, you know, the air moving, mm-hmm. the heat. Mm-hmm. And next to me was this man. He would have been probably about 55, 60, and he was wearing thongs. Now, I know that's nothing, but for me, thongs were like, what on earth are they, right? And he's wearing a tank top, and he's got a beer in his hand, and he's got these happy pants on, like these things, and this dry desert kind of land. And I looked at him and I looked at Mum and I just went, Mum, when are we going home? And she grabbed me by the hand and she said, we are never going home.
Oh.
I just thought, oh, my God, like we are never going home. Like that's not possible. Like, how could we not be going home? Do they not get it? Like, why are we here? But the reality is that there were times that my mum really did want to go home, even when we were in the refugee camp in Yugoslavia. But she couldn't anymore because she would be arrested. And she was really afraid if she was arrested, what would actually happen to my brother and I? Well, her and my dad would be both arrested. So that decision might have sounded adventurous, and the freedom and everything that they would have felt like they would have got. But the reality, because we were very poor for a very long time, you know, I've got many memories of my mum crying, holding bags from Salvation Army, you know, going through it. I think the reality of what they went through, neither of them had expected. But, yeah, for me as a child, it was this real loneliness, and I couldn't understand why you would leave your family behind.
That's a pretty complex collection of emotions to have as a child. So when you talk about that, was there this kind of feeling of like, oh my God, I'm physically leaving my house with all my stuff? Or was it really this kind of sense of belonging that you were longing for?
I think it was longing for what was.
Yeah.
This feeling of security. You know, I didn't worry much as a child in how I felt. Like, we never had a lot of money, but we had, you know, we were comfortable, but we had adventure, and we had each other, and we had, you know, my grandparents, and I had my nieces and nephews, and, you know, I had really lovely friends at school. Like, I remember being really happy at school, and my mum was actually the kindergarten teacher too, so, like, I was, like, super special because, you know, like, my mum was the kindergarten teacher. I just remember, yeah, feeling content. And so I went, and I felt from feeling content to feeling real emptiness. And unfortunately, that emptiness did last a long time, because I don't think anyone really recognised that, because my parents were so busy looking after the financial stuff, if that makes sense, that security.
I mean, I resonate with so much of what you're saying as a migrant, and I think, you know, how you're talking about as a child, that intuition of, oh, everything feels safe and calm, to then suddenly going to a space of now there's a level of anxiety in my home, or there's a level of distress, even if no one's talking about it, and particularly the financial, like, what are we going to do and how are we going to navigate this strange world of Australia? But then you started school in Australia.
Mm.
Did that help, or how was that for you?
Yeah, so I went to a school, and then they had separate classes for migrants, English speaking, for 6 months. And we had the most beautiful teacher. Like, if I could have her all the way through my life, I would say to you, that would have been amazing. And I settled in there really well, because I only knew one word English, so, you know, which was hello, I don't even know. I think my mum forced it down me. I was like, you have to start learning something. Yeah, so then I learn, and I learn a lot of English by just listening to people, which I think a lot of probably people who emigrate here do. Like, it's more of that interaction and listening, and that was good. But then my parents had bought a house, it's almost broken down house that they were going to renovate. We moved from the area to another school, and unfortunately, I'd love to tell you that it was great, but I experienced one of the most severe bullying, racism that Australia could possibly give you. And it was just maybe that pocket of Adelaide, that TV show, Go Back to Where You Came From.
Yeah.
I got told that every day. I got told I was called mole face, go back to where you came from, you've got a disease. You know, all that. It was just terrible. And I didn't have any of that. Like, and I'm white as well. Like, you think about what other people must have gone through who are of colour. Like, you know, it was...
Well, that's... So just going back to your first school, the migrant kids or the refugee kids were separated then into these English classes for 6 months.
Yep.
You were all together.
All different ages.
All different ages learning English.
Yeah.
Then you get plucked out and you go to this new school
where
you're then in mainstream.
Yes.
Mainstream.
That's right. Yes.
That would be full on. Yeah. Were you the only child from refugee migrant background then in that school?
Yeah, pretty much. Okay. Yeah, my brother and I were the only ones. Yeah.
Did your brother have the same sort of stuff happening to him?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
I think that's my husband is from Croatia, and he had the same. He ended up spending most of his school years in the school library. Like, that's where he found his refuge.
Yeah.
They'd even give him shit about what he'd eat for lunch.
Yeah. I was actually going to say, my mum would make me these. Sandwiches were foreign.
Yeah.
You know, in Czech Republic, breakfast and lunch are your biggest meals of the day, and dinner is like usually like a soup. Mm. And actually back under communist regime, everyone got given lunches at school and at work. And so we had these really like, and I'm talking, you know, dumplings and roasts and goulashes. And so it wasn't, you know, something. So I never grew up with sandwiches. And my mum couldn't get her head around sandwiches, so she would still try to make them, you know, steal some sort of Czech. So I would have these hamburgers made with garlic, onion, caraway seeds. Everything would be like smelling. Now if I brought it into school at today's day and age, everybody would be like, oh my God, you give me some, you know. But it was, and so I would, it took me forever for mum to buy Vegemite. You know, and just put Vegemite in my sandwich, and that just felt like I'm not feeding you. You know, you need to be eating properly. So with the same experience, yeah.
It's something my hubby comments about a lot, because he says exactly what you just said about how his lunches now would be considered absolute delicacies in Australia. You know,
yeah, like, flipped around.
Yeah,
it but just it took a blows long time. It took a long time to get there.
But it's just like interesting, like as a kid, because, you know, I remember we struggled with the sandwich thing, and then my mum would put like curry in the sandwich.
Yes, yes, so the same.
And it was so delicious, because she would look at processed meat.
Yes.
Ham and be like, why would I feed my child that?
That's right. That's right.
Or like the Vegemite.
Yeah.
Like, I know a story. His dad brought home Vegemite. They put it on the toast. They take one bite, and his dad's like, these Aussies are crazy.
Yeah. Well, my dad made the mistake of thinking that it was Nutella and took a big spoon of it, and then you just saw his face just turn. Like, it was like, uh-oh.
Should come with a warning.
Yeah.
So was your life mostly in Adelaide at that stage, or did you eventually get back to Sydney with the family? What happened?
No, very much in Adelaide up until I was 28, 29.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But in between that, a lot had happened. My dad had, you know, a couple of heart attacks quite young, and they went on a holiday to Victoria, and they found a property here in Victoria, and they decided to move from Adelaide to Victoria, and they left my brother and I there. We were 18, 19. They thought that we would come with them, and I didn't want to move again. And in fact, that's something that I've very much hold now, is the fact that, you know, I didn't want to I didn't want to make that move. Like, I had friends. I started to actually find myself. It took pretty much, 10 years for me to feel comfortable. And it's only been much later that I could say to you that I feel at home. Like, when I open my door to my house, I walk out of my house, I don't have any feelings other than that I belong. Yeah. So whereas before they were quite different. And so my parents just decided, and they were living like hippies in their van on this property. And it's a beautiful property. They've cleared it. They've done amazing work. But again, they just kind of went. And so then I had my son at 24 and my daughter 18 months later. And my their father, my husband at the time, he got offered a work transfer to Melbourne to work in Victoria. And he said, look, your mum would help with the kids. Your mum is very much, hands-on. Let's be closer. And so that's how we ended up coming to Victoria, was the fact that that sense of family again was lost, because I had these two young children that I absolutely adored, but it was just me and the children and my husband, and that family is again, not there. So, moved to be closer to my parents.
So did you have then like almost a decade of not seeing your parents that regularly, mm-hmm. while you were in Adelaide and they were living in a van in a hippie style lifestyle?
Yeah. Wow. They came down every now and again. My brother ended up buying the family home with his wife. And they mum resigned from her job, which was, I thought, was probably one of the biggest mistakes that she made. I think she left her work too early.
Yeah.
But yeah, and they just started working on the property. They built their own house. They cleared.
Really adventurous.
Incredibly adventurous. Yeah.
I feel, as you tell this story, just all I can hear is my husband's story. Like, it's incredible, like building the house and all that sort of stuff. It's just incredible. So my latest parents did, built the house themselves, literally.
Yes, yeah. And I actually helped them build the house. Yeah. I was mixing the mortar. So the bricks, the mortar that connects the bricks, I actually mixed by hand. Yeah. Like the ceilings of all the plasterboards and everything. The floorboards are from the trees in Jembrook that they knocked down, and they sat there for years, and then they had made into floorboards. I lay down with my dad. Like, I did all that hard work with them. But yeah, they do everything themselves, and then they hunt for something. They want one thing. Often some people might go, okay, I want one thing. They look it up and they find it. Whereas my parents dwell on it, and they investigate it, and 3 years later they get it. It's like, I think it must be a European thing. I don't know whether it's an Aussie thing, but
they probably make sure they've got the money to pay for it before they do it too.
Yeah,
that's a big thing.
Yeah, and they built their house for $70,000.
Yeah. Probably paid for it as they went.
Yeah, they did,
And that's probably worth so much more now.
Yeah, absolutely.
The question that's really going through my mind is, how have you stayed connected to the family in Czechoslovakia?
Mm, not hugely.
Okay.
I stayed connected to my grandmother, but I wasn't able to talk to my grandmother for 7 years.
Yeah.
Okay.
Until the communist regime. And then there's almost a disconnection, and it is something that I regret. So I do call my grandmother, and when I speak to her, all I hear is sadness. Even now, she's 93, and she's, all I can feel is sadness in her voice. My mum has disconnected from her sister, so they don't actually talk at all. Okay. So there's no able to be connection there with the family. And my dad's parents died when he was very young, when he was 16 and 17, and then his brother died, so that family. But the connection to my nieces and nephews is not there, because the family's broken.
Have you been back to Czechoslovakia?
Yeah, I've been back, a few times.
Yeah.
Some few times I've actually seen my uncle and my auntie, my mum's sister and her husband and her family. And I did get to actually at that time meet my dad's brother, who was still alive. And so Yes, and we do have friends there that we keep in contact with through Facebook. But that's something that I think I've inherited probably from my parents. Like they almost disconnected family once they arrived. I don't know whether it's the 7 years of not being able to talk to anyone or it's their nature, but they have never really made a massive effort to maintain connection. Very unusual, I think. Yeah.
It was really interesting hearing you talk about your parents and that move to Victoria and that buying a property almost on a whim and then being very, very happy to live in a van and just live a very alternate lifestyle to what was happening at the time for them. Do you think that their experience with migration impacted the way they saw not only traveling but also like establishing a home? Because a lot of people would see it as once you've got children, you'd settle down and that would be it. But it seems as though their perception would be slightly different if they were feeling that they could just kind of get up and leave like that.
Yeah, Luke, I think my parents were always searching for home again. Absolutely. And they never found home in Adelaide. And I knew that 100%. And so when they stepped into Jembrook, it was overgrown. It was actually an old orchard. But the owner had actually been stabbed by a bull into the stomach trying to save a young little girl from. So he jumped over the fence and, you know, threw the little girl over. But he himself got, you know, stabbed in the stomach. He continued to live and he held on to the property for 20 years, but it had overgrown, and it's 10 acres and it's got a 1 acre self streaming dam. And the way Mum describes it is almost like a fairy tale. They walk through the property and they see the potential, and then they walk to the end where there's this dam and they held each other's hand and they went, this just feels right, doesn't it? And so you're absolutely right. They've always been searching, and my mum has told me many times the first time she felt at home was when they found Jembrook. So, yeah, I think they'd always been searching, because before that they were, you know, they were looking to live near the beach.
Yeah.
You know, maybe near the beach would be better. Then they wanted to look in Adelaide Hills. Maybe Adelaide Hills would be better. Like, they were always looking to try and search for what was that feeling of home.
A little bit of Europe.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I imagine Jembrook, you know, with its hills and its, like, climate and visually, apart from the kangaroos and the wildlife, would remind them of being in Europe and...
Yeah.
That kind of setting, so that makes sense.
And it does for me. It's just the most beautiful days you can have there, where, you know, you're up at 5:30 in the morning and it's just stillness and it's beautiful, and it's that feeling of nature and earth that you get when you're there, that nothing else can give that feeling to you. And then a slight breeze comes through and leaves fall off the trees, and it's just incredible. And absolutely, time stops in moments, and yeah,
it's, I can, a fairy, see why, tale.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question about your own children?
Mm-hmm.
Are your children bilingual?
No.
Okay. Yeah.
And that is my biggest disappointment, in that I think I failed. Absolutely. I tried to justify it by saying that because I had them in Adelaide and there was nobody around, I had only my husband to speak to, really, and other, you know, people, and nobody spoke Czech. And then when we came to Victoria, I didn't even, Mum, we all just were speaking English to the children. They do understand. Yeah, they do, but they can't speak it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if I could turn back time, Fiona, that is the one thing that I would, I cannot believe. I don't even know why. Like, I just, yeah. So now we're in the process of, I'm learning Spanish with my son. And once he learns Spanish, he's actually going to go learn Czech. So I'm learning Spanish for him and he's going to learn Czech for me. Like, that's, so I'm applying for a dual citizenship. So it's like I'm trying to make up for that, because that's, I fully carry that. Like, it's, I can't even, yeah.
One of the things that migrant kids often feel is that they're living in these two dynamic worlds of family of origin and then culture of origin and then the culture of the place that they've moved to. And I'm just wondering how you have felt or your experience of navigating expectations and culture and tradition as you've grown up and become your own self, what that was like?
I have to say, I think for me, the way that people live and celebrate things are not too in check, are not too different from Australia. You know, we celebrate Christmas, we celebrate Easter, we have our, you know, our special foods and things like that and the silly kind of things that we do during those events. But they are very similar. So I never really judged or was challenged at all in that way or to conform in that way. It was more around, you know, how I dressed, how I spoke, how I thought. You know, my thought processes are different. You know, I am from somewhere else. I do think differently. And, so that was probably more the difference in me, who I actually am, rather than the culture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But even going back to, like, how you dress and how you think, was that a family expectation, cultural expectation, that you would look a particular way that was important to them?
No, because they were so poor, all the clothes were from Salvation Army. Look, yes, actually yes, in the sense that in Czech Republic you would never go to a supermarket in tracksuit pants. Like, you get fully dressed to go to the supermarket. You wear it, you know. And so my mum was always dressing me, overdressing me to things, and I always felt really out. But that's pretty much. And then and it's the way that you were and behaved around people, you know. You actually, as a child, you were visible but invisible. You know, don't make noise, don't make comments, comply. There was a lot of submission. Whereas when I grew up, my children, because I know what that feels like, I'm very different. I'm very much, you know, you respectfully voice your opinion. You stand up for yourself. You make sure you know what you want in life. Go searching for it. You've got your young time is, you've got time. Spend time knowing what you want, whereas I was brought up very much to comply, to listen, to be a good girl. And there is actually quite a lot of, there was actually a lot of, you know, gender with, especially like around what girls and boys were supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm with my children, I'm very different. Doesn't matter. Go for it. You know, if that's what you want to do, you know. And I sometimes laugh because my son walks out in a pink nightgown sometimes. You know, like, and he's got two earrings in his ears, you know, two little stud earrings, and he's such a beautiful boy, and he doesn't care. Like, you know, goes to the letterbox with his pink nightgown that he's got from his girlfriend, and, you know, they are so much more free. I grew up far more confined to what children are supposed to be, which is, you know, be there but be invisible and be good. Yeah.
I think that's a very Gen X thing as well as culturally. Yeah, if I put it in my context, when I'm thinking when we grew up in the 80s.
Yeah.
But then you mentioned, like, you got married young, and then in your 30s you were like, that's it, I'm going to use my brain, I've got a brain. And you kind of maybe challenged what would have been considered a normal pathway at that point?
Absolutely. I think, and this is, you know, I'm happy to share it. I think my dad would have been happy if I was a cleaner.
Oh.
You know, why are you doing this? But it was just, I've always felt a drive that I've got in me, something that makes me just go for it and challenge those expectations of being a good little girl. I've always had that, and I've always been, I think I'm a different egg. Sometimes I think to myself, did I come from someone else? Because my mum's much more submissive. I'm far more, you know, like, standing up for myself in that way. But absolutely, my mum was thrilled. My mum was excited. She really wanted me to get the education, because education is power.
Yeah.
Knowledge is power. Knowledge is, you know, and it allows you to have more control over where you want to go and what you do in life. But certainly was challenged, and my dad specifically did not understand and did not expect me to succeed.
Because you were going outside of a gender role as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You're a mother.
Yes. Yeah.
Why would you be doing this?
Yes.
That's your purpose.
That's right.
Yeah.
Your purpose is to be a mother, and that's it.
Yeah.
And, you know. why would you want to do anything else?
Does he love it now, though?
No.
Seriously? So he hasn't come around?
No.
Wow, that I'm surprised about.
Yeah, yeah, no, unfortunately not.
Very traditional.
Yeah, yeah, very traditional. And he wouldn't have any idea what I do.
Yeah.
Or, you know, anything about my work and isn't interested in knowing anything, which is quite kind of sad. But I've got other people around me that are, so it's okay.
Hearing him privately, you might be surprised. Like, he might be very proud of you.
Yeah, yeah, might be. I don't know.
I feel like it's such a European man thing from that generation.
It's what they understand. Yeah. Like, if you're doing things outside the norm, maybe they're not like, I'm not sure how to make sense of
it's
what
just with
you
those
do.
Gender roles, it really is. Yeah. Yeah. Because that's the way they were brought up.
Yes. Yeah. And I think what's really funny for him is that all of his expectations of what people and women and men should be are all breaking up around him. Mm. So, for example, my brother cooks. He's the cook in his family. And my dad just goes like, he's like, he can't get his head around the fact that my brother cooks. And actually my brother will say to my dad, because my brother still lives in Adelaide, he'll say, but Dad, I love to cook for my family. He's like, no, you're lying. You know, you are forced to cook. I was like, no, I'm not forced to cook. I actually genuinely, he goes, look, listen. He goes, my wife is not a very good cook at all. If I ate her food, I'd be eating Bilo brand, you know, steamed dim sims for dinner every night. He goes, and she doesn't know how to cook the traditional Czech food. And so when I speak to my brother on his way back from work, you know, so what are you cooking tonight? And he will say to me, you know, Klendove Przozelo, which is like, you know, roast dumplings and with sauerkraut. Yum. And he's happy to cook. And so he's challenged. And my brother doesn't have an education. Mm. You know, he works for a LED light company. Like, it's only two of them. It's a small business. And they do all the LED lights for churches and people around Adelaide. He's very good with his brain and hands together. He's got this really great talent. And that's where he wants to be. He loves playing his guitar at night. He's got no interest in going to university and growing. And then he's got me, who is educated. And then he's really against left-handers, and both my girls are left-handers. Like, he's being challenged. My son's got earrings, you know, like little studs in his ears. And he's continuously challenged by what is supposed to be, like, perfect society. By the fact that his own family is evolving in their own way, a way that they choose to evolve, because he can't, you know, have choice in that anymore.
I would like to think that in those countries, like in Croatia, Czechoslovakia, that the men are evolving.
Yes.
That these traditional roles are breaking down a little bit, I hope.
Oh, absolutely they are. They are absolutely 100% breaking down. And they say the same things about their fathers and mothers, you know, like what they're like, and what the people in the, you know, certainly that I communicate with through Facebook, you know, they go on holidays, they... You know, often the wives are more of decision makers, and they're quite happy to sit back and let that be. Like, there's much more dynamic in the relationships, and women are earning in diverse ways, and they're, you know, really intelligent. Like, I do have to say, and I don't, this is not saying that other nations aren't, but Czechs are actually really smart people.
Yes.
And but equally, men and women are smart, and so women are very much becoming professionals and having children later as well, like owning their space. So it's really nice to see. It's definitely progressing.
Marta, thank you so much for your time today. I've got one last question for you. What are your hopes moving for the future?
I would probably answer that in a very simple way and probably just say happiness. I genuinely just mean just content and happiness. I think life can throw at you, and certainly you can be surrounded by so many things that can really affect you. But actually, just moving forward in a really positive way, and having maintaining my family connections and having my family around me is probably the key.
Hi, Fiona here. Thanks for taking the time to listen to the XYZ Experiment podcast. And don't forget to leave a rating and review. If you enjoyed our show, tell all your friends and family and subscribe. Follow us on Instagram at the XYZ Experiment for all the latest updates and news. Our original music was composed and performed by Luke Champion.